I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. Kiva robots deliver inventory shelves to stationary human operators who then pick and pack the product and send it off for shipping. Mick started Kiva Systems in 2003, and the company was acquired by Amazon for $775 million in spring 2012. Customers include Diapers.com and Zappos, both owned by Amazon, Saks Fifth Avenue, Staples, Toys R Us, and The Gap, among others. Prior to founding Kiva, Mick worked in high-tech product development at Motorola, Apple, and the online grocery company Webvan. Mick is a graduate of MIT and Harvard Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
I want to start by understanding the traditional warehouse. Could you describe briefly the day in the life of a warehouse worker?
Yeah, the traditional warehousing, at least what I was experiencing in the late 90s, was characterized by a lot of conveyors and forklifts and other static, stationary shelving devices. Classically, a pick worker would grab a tote or a cart or some device and some RF picking device that might be mounted to their wrist, and they would follow the instructions and walk from location to location in the warehouse to find those items. And sometimes they pick an order at a time or multiple orders at a time, but they're going out to gather the inventory, bring it back to somebody else who's then going to do the pack out. And when we started Kiva, we turned that whole equation on its head and said, what if all of the inventory in the warehouse could walk and talk on its own and just come to you, the pick-pack worker?
A typical pick worker can walk 5 to 10 miles a day and spend, you know, 70% of their time walking around the warehouse. I've heard you say before that regarding the experience of a worker, not only is this an unproductive way to fill orders, it's also an unfulfilling way to fill orders.
Yeah, it can be a kind of a rough job, and we're talking about direct labor in the factory setting that's probably being paid on the order of $10, $12, $14 an hour. And it's interesting for a while, but then it becomes pretty routine pretty quickly. Part of the unfulfilling part, at least, is that a lot of the technologies and existing processes don't allow you to do your job well. So you get to a location and you're supposed to get a red T-shirt and you're out of red T-shirts. And so then you end up spending all this extra time looking for where did they put the extra red T-shirts. And when obviously we tried to change that whole equation with our approach.
With Kiva Systems, instead of the workers going to get the inventory comes to them. Can you describe that process briefly?
Sure. So instead of walking out to a location to get the T-shirts, we send mobile robots that travel on the ground out to get underneath a mobile shelving pod. It's an inventory pod that contains lots of different items. We pick it up just an inch or two off the ground, and then we drive that shelving unit all the way over to where the pick worker is standing. And then they present themselves in a serial fashion in front of the pick worker so that every 6 seconds they can reach out their hand and pick another item of inventory. It allows the pick worker access to every single item of the inventory without moving their feet.
How fast do these robots move around the warehouse? What's the mile per hour?
It's interesting. It's super slow. What we did is model the robots after the speed that humans would be walking, say, for example, in a grocery store, about 3 feet per second. And so when you see a bunch of them in the building, they're all kind of moving at a walking pace, yet they're getting a lot of work done very quickly because the human operator experiences a continuous pick face in front of them.
The warehouses look like a mini city on a grid system. It's like traffic, like cars moving around. How much did maps and the idea of automobile traffic play into your vision of what the warehouses would look like?
The way we approach it is less about like highway traffic and more about just a reservation-based system. So as they drive, they're reserving small stickers in this grid system, and as they get to the next sticker, they release the last sticker. Our software control system is probably more better described as an air traffic control system, which is deciding who gets to go when, where, and why. And then that creates this fluid set of motion amongst all of the robots.
Where does the name Kiva come from?
It is a Hopi Indian word that means meeting place of the ant people, or loosely ant colony. And so we use the term Kiva because our original logo was an ant carrying a package. It was kind of like the ant colony at your picnic that carries off all of your food.
Also, ants are complex organisms who are very strong. I think an ant can carry multiple times its weight.
True. I hadn't thought about the individual ant strength analogy until you pointed it out. But yeah, our robots weigh about 250 pounds and they carry a 1,000-pound payload around of shelving. But the real metaphor that I like is at the systems level, an ant colony is a very robust organism and it's really hard to kill. Mm. Once you get ants in your kitchen, really hard to get rid of them. So we are similar. Our approach to solving this warehouse inventory picking problem is to use hundreds and thousands, if not thousands, of robots in a building, all with a little bit of information, but collectively very capable of getting the work done and very robust.
One of the things that Kiva Systems does is track the popularity of a product. So let's say it's Valentine's Day. There'll be more pink candies being procured or fulfilled than Christmas time. So the robots are able to, the shelves are able to be moved to farther away from the human operators than those products that are more popular.
That's right. One of the side effects of making everything mobile in the warehouse is that you can now dynamically and adaptively tune the layout of the warehouse. And so as more chalky pink candy is being ordered, all of that stuff kind of moves to the front of the warehouse. But the day after Valentine's Day, as nobody's ordering that stuff, it starts to drift to the back of the warehouse and get out of the way. And traditional warehouses would have tackled that problem by bringing a crew of humans in over the weekend to re-slot the warehouse and move all that stuff around. And in our system, it just happens automatically.
I'd like to talk about the cost of the robots. A startup kit for these robots is, you know, $1 to $2 million. And if you have a warehouse of, let's say, 1,000 robots, that's, you know, close to $20 million. And it takes you, you know, 6 months to plan and set up the grid system. How did you justify the cost to potential customers in the early days?
There's a pretty well-known kind of trade-off, which we call the 2-year CapEx versus OpEx trade-off. I'll gladly spend $1 million if I'm going to save $500,000 a year for the next 2 years. Mm. And if you can hit that 2-year CapEx-OpEx trade-off, the automation projects tend to get approved pretty quickly. And in our case, to bring this disruptive solution to market, we had to do a lot of innovation around the business itself. We had to approach our potential clients with a brand new pricing model that took the risk out of the equation for them. So when they were thinking about converting from a conveyor-based system to a Kiva, we knew it would work, but they weren't quite so comfortable. So we'd say, look, if we get all the way to the end and you still don't like it, you can send it back.
You mentioned disruption. Kiva is a disruptive technology. It's not just a bunch of robots delivering products in a traditional warehouse. You really have changed the paradigm of the warehouse. What other companies do you look to who have been equally disruptive in their own industries?
There's a lot. Along the way, we used to think about who else has dealt with similar disruptive challenges when they grew their business. And companies like Southwest Airlines would come to mind. People always laugh about low-cost Southwest Airlines, but yet it's the only profitable airline over an extended 10 to 15-year period. And how do they do that? Well, they just take a very robust and simple approach. They use one aircraft, a 737, for all their flights. They originally had a open seating policy, so people really would hustle to get in and get their seats. And they took a very fun approach to flying, too. Another one we always used to talk about was FedEx. Today, you think about the ability to overnight a package from almost anywhere in the world next day. And that capability didn't exist, you know, 20 or I guess it was about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It was unheard of.
we were talking about convincing customers to adopt Kiva, and your first customer was Staples. How did that happen?
The introduction, so we identified Staples as a likely consumer of the Kiva solution, and we had emailed into just about everybody we knew from every angle over there without much success. But when we were out seeking venture funding, the team at Bain Capital actually was able to introduce us to Staples.
Bain Capital was your investor, but they weren't among the early investors whom you approached. You got about 100 no's before you finally met them. What was the appetite among venture capitalists when you were presenting this idea?
The first few years would have been 2002 and 2003. I was still living in Palo Alto in the Bay Area. And so naturally, I was traveling Sand Hill Road, meeting with a lot of venture teams out there. And, you know, it wasn't a great time for raising money. They were still licking their wounds from the dot-com crash of 2001. And we were a hardware play. And so at this point, they were looking for the next software company or some internet-type play that could grow quickly on unlimited amount of capital. And so, yes, to your point, we had the door closed in our face quite a bit. And they used to say things like, you're going to need $100 million to get this thing to cash flow break even, and then some. So I became convinced, actually, in those early years that maybe venture capital was not the right funding model for Kiva, this capital-intensive business. So I end up working my network, friends of friends, to find some investors that got it and that wanted to take a risk. I managed to meet up with a gentleman named Sam Kinney, who was one of the co-founders of Free Markets, which was a 1999 very successful internet startup. Anyway, I met up with him. He introduced me to additional co-founders and early employees of Free Markets, and we started to put together kind of a $1.6 million Series A round to get the company to do a proof of concept.
How firm was your conviction that you thought this was viable and this would work, especially in the face of multiple no's?
I knew that it could work, but, you know, as a first-time entrepreneur, CEO, all that stuff, I probably didn't appreciate all of the challenge that were going to be involved in building the company. But you have that kind of that naivete that actually makes you think you can do it, which is useful, very useful, actually.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, founder of Kiva Systems. We'll hear more from Mick Mounts coming up. Jessica Harris, this is From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. Kiva robots deliver inventory shelves to stationary human operators who then pick and pack the product and send it off for shipping. Mick started Kiva Systems in 2003, and the company was acquired by Amazon for $775 million in spring 2012. Customers include Diapers.com and Zappos, both owned by Amazon, Saks Fifth Avenue, Staples, Toys R Us, and The Gap, among others. So I want to talk some more about the early days of the company. You were sleeping on friends' couches, and what was your burn rate personally?
Burn rate on me physically or burn rate cash-wise, the checkbook, all of that?
You tell me.
So the reason I was sleeping on people's couches is because I was keeping the burn rate near zero. I remember in that year, I think it was in 2003, something like 300 days on the road that year, 299 on other people's beds or couches, and one night in a Red Roof Inn because I just couldn't drive any further and had to pull over. And it said $29.99 for the night.
What was your social life at the time with such a nomadic existence?
I was single, dating at the time, so I didn't have a lot that tied me down or restricted me from kind of taking this leap with both feet.
We talked before about Staples being your first customer. How important was that in being a catalyst for other retailers to come on board?
Yeah, so Staples is a very interesting story. We had identified a list of about 25 customers that we just thought, if all of these customers are using Kiva, then we've arrived. And Staples was on that list. And we were pleasantly surprised at the conversation when they came by. Only kind of in the ensuing year did we put together the reasons why they acted so quickly. But they were in a hyper-competitive space, just office supplies, and it was them against Office Depot, against Office Max, against Corporate Express. All of these guys are effectively selling the same 3M yellow Post-it notes and red pens. And so how do you differentiate in that environment? Well, it's through your pick, pack, and ship fulfillment capability. And so Staples saw our stuff and thought, geez, if this works, we probably ought to know about it, and wouldn't it be great if Office Depot didn't know about it? And so in that competitive context, they moved very quickly to try it. And then we quickly followed with Walgreens, later with Zappos and Gap and some others. And I think there was a critical mass building. You could see some of the leading online retailers using our stuff. And so that became kind of a self-fulfilling thing where most people who wanted to solve this problem would come and talk to us because we had a lot of the key accounts.
There were other people who started Kiva with you, including Pete Warman and Raffaello D'Andrea. How do you know them?
So Pete Warman is my roommate from MIT. He was teaching computer science and as it related to e-commerce, and he knew exactly how to make this thing work from a software standpoint. And I met Raff through another friend of ours, Mary Lane Vandermeulen, who was sitting across the hall from him at Cornell as a professor. I showed him what we wanted to do with these robots, and this built on everything that he had been doing in his academic career with controlling complex systems. He's a controls expert that can make these systems operate robustly.
One example of a robot that he built is a soccer robot.
That's right. You'd put five autonomous robots on a little mini soccer field against some other university, and the 10 robots would go at it autonomously. And his RoboCup teams at Cornell were winning every year. And when I showed Raff what we were working on, it was almost like falling off a log compared to playing soccer. We had a controlled environment. We could put down a grid. Nobody can go in there. There's no opponent that you have to outguess. You just have to control these things. So he signed up pretty quickly.
You mentioned that one of your co-founders was your roommate at MIT. You've had a couple of other friends join the company and also family members. Your father worked at the company. What was his role?
That's right. So I would talk to my dad about every other weekend, and I could tell he was getting more and more interested and getting kind of sucked into the process. And one day I just said, hey, why don't you just stop what you're doing and just move out. He was in Phoenix at the time. Move out to Boston and work on this. It'd be much more fun. You can do it full time. I don't have to call you every Sunday. So he took me up on it and came out, worked in our supply chain group using his logistics background.
You have one sister who's a helicopter pilot for the military, but you have another, your older sister has joined Kiva.
She was a part-time assistant in our HR team for a number of years. And my brother-in-law, her husband, had a PhD in robot path planning. Go figure. So he and my sister Cindy and family moved from the Chicago area to Boston. She was the sole person in our HR department almost up until like employee number 100, all part-time.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics fulfillment company. Customers include Crate & Barrel, Timberland, The Gap, and Staples. Kiva Systems was acquired by Amazon in spring 2012 for $775 million. Incidentally, in 2008, you were watching the Beijing Olympics, and you've mentioned that the opening ceremony was in some way a parallel to what you were doing at Kiva. How is that?
Right. So in 2008, my wife and I are watching the Beijing opening ceremonies on TV, and they show 2,000 people on the stadium floor making art. And I said to my wife, hey, that was the idea for Kiva. Just put lots and lots of people on the warehouse floor, and they can do some very interesting collaborative things. Of course, we didn't end up using people. We used robots to do it. But I was fascinated by the opening ceremonies there because they were able to make some incredible artwork, and I was told it was all done without computers, but just peer-to-peer with them working it out amongst themselves and coordinating.
I want to go back to when you hatched the idea for Kiva. You had been working at Webvan, which is the online grocery delivery company that raised hundreds of millions of dollars of venture capital and went bankrupt, perhaps because they were too early for their time and they didn't have this logistics framework baked into it. Could you describe how you came up with the idea briefly?
Sure. I mean, my experience at Webvan was the genesis. That's where I was able to experience at least the problem firsthand. That company was taking online grocery orders, much like a Peapod or in New York City, a Fresh Direct. And what would happen is the cost of fulfilling the order, delivering the order, and having the customer support relationship, those total costs would completely overwhelm the margin on that grocery order. And so clearly, part of the reason the company went out of business was it was losing money on every order. And my job at Webvan was to think about next generation fulfillment solutions. The internet was new, e-commerce was new. There hadn't been much kind of clean thinking around what does it mean to get one green t-shirt, one toothpaste, one can of soup in a tote, a box, or a bag. So this notion of each-based picking I felt was unsolved, and I racked my brain for a year over there trying to think about how to do this. The existing solutions just didn't stack up, and about a year and a half later, it was still bugging me, and that's how that's when I really got started on the problem.
We talked about Webvan's influence on Kiva's development, but you also worked at Apple starting in 1996. You were at Apple for about 3 years, and you were helping to move technology onto their desktop platform. This is also when Steve Jobs returned to Apple. Similar to Apple, at Kiva, you really control every step of the product chain, of the design, the aesthetic, the software, the robot operators, the stickers, everything from cradle to grave. And that's somewhat reflective of what Apple did. Can you explain that?
For sure.
That linkage?
That's right. So we're bringing a very complex solution to market, and we're going to put this in a customer's warehouse. So it just has to work. And so we decided to take the same approach that Apple did when they would develop a technology like the original iPod, for example. The reason it was in some sense so successful is Apple not only made the iPod, but they were involved in the USB interface to the Mac. They made the logic board for the Mac. They made the operating system that ran on the logic board, and they made the iTunes software that connected to the iPod. So rather than having to think through and deal with all those technologies, the consumer was able to just listen to music.
What are some of your memories of Steve Jobs? Like, are there any, random stories that come to mind from those days?
You learn a lot through osmosis when you see somebody like that. And I kind of had a front row seat for the turnaround. And when he got back in 97, the company was working on all kinds of different projects. And one of the things I remember was that meeting where he rolled out the new 2x2. We make desktops and portables, and we make consumer and professional. And if you're not in one of those four boxes, you can leave. Everything else is going to be shuttered. And luckily, I was in the desktop professional box. Mm-hmm. And then he said in that same meeting, so which one of these are we? We have this product, what are we missing? We're missing the consumer desktop. And so he had already developed the thesis and was working on his iMac vision. What I also remember about those days at Apple was everything became even more secret and super secret. And so I would, the guy in the product marketing manager in the office next to me would be working on the iMac and couldn't tell me anything about it, whereas only, you know, a year earlier we were all working on these projects together and sharing experiences.
How did you feel about that level of secrecy within the same company?
It was different, but it was completely understood that, geez, if your customer knows that the next version of the product is coming out, they're not going to buy the current version. So it was understood why.
Any other anecdotes, impressions of him?
Well, when I was working there, I used to tell my friends in the Bay Area, it's very interesting because he's so smart and his, you know, his passion and vision for the industry is really compelling, but I think he succeeds despite himself. And that, you know, with just small changes to the way he treats people or leads, he could be even more effective.
You founded Kiva Systems in 2003 and were acquired by Amazon in 2012. How did that acquisition happen? Did they approach you? Were they a customer of yours to begin with?
Amazon directly was not a customer of Kiva. In fact, that was the number one question that we would get from other clients or prospective investors was, hey, why isn't Amazon using this? In our sales efforts, we would make the kind of annual trip out to Seattle to try to convince Amazon that they ought to use a Kiva system in one of their warehouses for pick, pack, and ship. And in 2012, the conversation got more interesting as they said, okay, but if we're going to do that, we'd like to own the whole company.
Did you think that maybe they would try to build it themselves in-house?
That's always a real possibility, but I wasn't too worried about that because we'd been at it for, say, 8 or 9 years at that point.
Yeah.
And we developed a ginormous portfolio of patents, and we've solved a lot of hard problems. So even patents aside, some of the things we figured out how to do are very hard to learn. And so given that technology challenge, we weren't too worried about other people copying it.
At the time Amazon acquired you, you had been fulfilling orders for Diapers.com and Zappos, who were owned by Amazon. So perhaps that helped.
It did help. We think it helped. So for a moment there, we thought about changing our marketing tagline to say, buy Akiva, get bought by Amazon. Mm. We didn't end up doing that because then, of course, it happened to us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mick Mounts, the founder of Kiva Systems, a mobile robotics company that automates the warehouse fulfillment process. I want to talk about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Frankfurt, Germany, in a U.S. Army hospital. My dad was in the military, so we had that classic Army brat upbringing where we were moving every couple of years somewhere new. I think I had 9 different schools by the time I finished high school or 12th grade.
What kind of child were you? What kind of kid were you?
I guess the funniest thing I can think about my childhood was when I was an adult already in my 20s, I took the Myers-Briggs test, and it comes out ENTJ.
What does that mean?
No, ENTP. So ENTJ is this classic leader profile where people who run companies, but I'm not that. I'm ENTP, which the tagline for that personality type was called One Exciting Challenge After Another. And I was showing it to my folks, said, supposedly this is my personality. And they started reading it, and they burst out laughing at the paragraph where it said, as a child, the ENTP, when asked to take out the trash, will spend the next 2 days trying to invent a system for the trash to take out itself rather than just doing the chore. And so they're like, that's you. That's absolutely you.
And along those lines, you tried to create, when you were, 11 years old, an automated process for doing your homework rather than you doing it yourself?
Yeah, my mom later, when I was running Kiva, sent me some old little clippings from the scrapbook kind of stuff that said, it was an essay, what do you want to invent? And I wanted to invent a machine that would do all my homework. And I feel like that was actually what I ended up working on at Apple, was my homework machine, the Mac.
Your parents were in the military. How were they as parents? Were they militaristic? Or
Probably quite the opposite. They just gave us a ton of support for whatever it was that we were interested in. So, my father and my mother were role models and influential, inspirational in different ways. So my dad was the kind of hard work ethic, always had to be doing something productive. And then he also taught me sports, right? So he was a college football player at the University of Illinois, and I developed a love of sports by hanging out with him. And then my mother had a scientific curiosity, so she would take me, for example, into the laundry room at age 7 and turn out the lights and say, watch this, and open the dryer drawer and dryer door, and all the clothes would spark as she was pulling them out. Mm. And so there was a lot of little memories like that that contributed, I think, to both my competitive nature through playing sports and working hard, and then my scientific curiosity that my mother kind of instilled.
You used to exercise a lot before you started Kiva and having kids.
That's right.
Now you have no time. You did yoga. You played baseball at MIT for 4 years. You ran triathlons.
Yeah, it kind of goes away when you have a startup and you're doing 80 to 100 hours a week. But so I was fortunate in that my early few years at Kiva, with my schedule, I could really get in great shape. And I was in great shape when I started the company. And, of course, now with three little ones at home, my priority is to try to get some time with them in the morning and in the evening before they get to bed.
I've been told that you drink a lot of coffee. Just how much are we talking about?
Well, so the coffee, the caffeine is a mental stimulus for me. I actually did an experiment 1 year where I tried to go a whole year without caffeine and without alcohol. And it turns out I ended up going a year and a half without alcohol. Didn't miss it, didn't need it. But the caffeine, for after 4 months, I could barely complete a sentence. And so I had to start drinking coffee again. So I'll have a couple of cups of coffee in the morning, kind of the perpetual cup, and then switch to maybe one or two Mountain Dews in the afternoon.
Mountain Dew because?
The caffeine.
Mm.
And the sugar, I guess. By then, I need the sugar, too.
And you like Lucky Charms cereal?
Yeah, there was a period there when we were getting the company going that I felt that not only Lucky Charms was a nutritious breakfast, but that it was having some impact on our ability to win new deals.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Mick Mounts, the co-founder of Kiva.
Coming up, we'll meet Andrew Goldsworthy, a leading sculptor who uses outdoor materials like wood, stone, and leaves.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is the sculptor Andy Goldsworthy. Andy's sculptures are made out of wood, stone, ice, leaves, water, and mud, and can last anywhere from a few seconds to hundreds of years. Andy lives in Scotland, but his work has been exhibited widely in the United States, including at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, Stanford and Princeton Universities, and the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art in California. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
You spend so much of your time working outdoors, and I'm wondering what your relationship with the outdoors was when you were growing up.
As a kid? Oh, well, I had a regular sort of time as a child. You know, I played in woods and on the beach. I don't remember making many sculptures as a kid, but art was always very important to me. That was the only thing I could do. That's the only thing I was made for, was to make art. It was the driving passion through all my education.
Were your parents artists?
No, my mother looked after us kids, and my father was a professor, a university professor of mathematics.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the outskirts of Leeds, which is a big city in the north of England. On one side was the city, and on the other side were the fields, the green belt, as they called it. So it's this really interesting edge between the two, and I think that probably had a big effect on the way I see things. Walking through the new suburbs, I always remembered where the trees were, where the swamps were, and I could, you know, it's just underneath this veneer of tarmac and building, the swamps and the trees were still there somehow. And I think that definitely informs how I look at the urban spaces now. It's like trying to get through the surface appearance of things to what is the, you know, the nature of an urban place.
When did it first occur to you that you wanted to have a career in this type of sculpture?
Well, I think career is probably the wrong word to use for an artist. You make art, and if a career happens through that, then great. But when you sign up for art, you could be signing up for working as a part-time gardener or whatever, just to support your work and have a very frugal life in terms of material things. But obviously have a fantastic life in terms of what you gain through what you make. I am very, very fortunate to be able to have both, you know, that I can make a living from my work.
But you haven't always had both.
Absolutely not, no. When I was a student, I lived off very little. And when I left college, I lived off very little too. And for the first 8 years, it was like that. And I worked as a part-time gardener and other things.
You also worked on a farm. How did farming inform your work at all?
That was very important. Farming is a very sculptural activity. You know, the way haystacks are made, the ploughing of a field. And it's also at times a very brutal experience being on a farm. There's the death of animals, the rawness of working with the land, the weather, the harshness of it, as well as an intense. It was a very powerful experience. When you're picking potatoes all day long, or picking wild oats from a field of oats, stacking bales, you do these long, repetitive tasks, and you build up a certain working rhythm, and that helps enormously when I'm making sculptures.
It implies a sense of patience in a way to be able to do the same thing and tolerate that over and over again. Do you feel intellectually stimulated by picking potatoes or doing your sculptures?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I don't consider myself to be incredibly patient. I'm very determined. Patience is something to do with knitting. It's like it's too intense to describe it in that way. The unpredictability and very tedious and repetitive.
Where does this come from? Were you always, as a child, a hardworking, intense individual?
Well, I wasn't considered particularly gifted academically. And I did pretty badly in a lot of the subjects at school, except for art. I'd have always done art with a certain obsessiveness, yeah.
Do you remember the first time you made money from your art?
Yeah, I was shortly after I left art school. At that time, the Arts Council of Britain used to buy art and make an exhibition every year, and it was a great honour for the purchaser that year was Dr. Andrew Causey, who was at Manchester University, and he bought some early photographs of mine, and I'll never forget it because he had to talk me up to £30.
What do your photographs go for these days?
Do you know, I have no idea. I imagine a few thousand dollars, but not huge. I mean, this is a really stupid kind of thing. I mean you, how many people have you interviewed that have said what I've just said? I mean, obviously, I do care. I'm sure there's some, I have files somewhere that will tell me exactly how much I paid.
I want to talk about the themes in your art. One theme that's recurring is the sense of time. How did the sense of time come into play, or how does the sense of time come into play with your work for some listeners who aren't aware of your work?
Well, when I first began working outside, one of the very earliest works that I made outside on the beach was made in many ways as a reaction to the static studio that I was supposed to be working in as a student. which I found incredibly difficult to work with. It's this place that didn't change, typically a white cube that students are given to work in. So you were met with these very contrasting images and experiences. You know, the college was very confined, very closed, very controlled, and this beach, which was different every day. And one day I just went out and made a couple of things on the beach, and the tide came in and washed them away, and I suddenly realized that I wasn't in control, and time was dictating what I should make, how I could make it. And many of the earlier works were made for the moment in which they were made. And then later on, I began to realize that moment is the way it is because of what has happened before. And then time became even more important. I mean, then I began to think of the future too. For instance, making a stone cairn on the beach, waiting for the tide to come in and engulf it.
You talk about a stone cairn, C-A-I-R-N.
Mm-hmm. Although my cairns don't look like any other cairn that's ever been made, they look more like a pine cone. I like to call them cairns because I like this association to marking a moment, a place, a journey.
To me, they look like eggs, and they have that fragility sometimes when they are part of the beach and they might be torn down by the tides.
I do not see stone as something static or dead. I try to see it as something alive and living.
What do you mean by there is an inner life in stone?
Well, I don't mean in some slight kind of hippie sort of ya-ya way. Stone, you look at the granite of Manhattan, you know, that's a fire-formed material. You know, when you go into Central Park and you see where it's exposed and revealed, there's a certain flow and movement and a sense of change about that, even though it is solid. You know, I've actually made sculptures where I've fired stones, taken solid stones and fired them in a kiln and seen them turn liquid. Very violent, but it's very, very powerful to see this stone tearing apart.
Did the kiln break?
My father-in-law at the time, he was a potter, and I borrowed his kiln in the early days. And yes, one of the I wrecked a kiln.
By the way, when you would go home during school to work on the beach, what did your teachers think of that? Was there any controversy surrounding that?
It was a little difficult for the tutors. I was rejected from three art colleges before I got in one at the end. I had more or less given up going to art school. I was going to go and be an artist. I was going the direct route. I wasn't going to bother with this. So, but my father, being in universities, rang round and found a place. He drove me for my interview, and I was the last but one person to be accepted at Lancaster Art College. Now, all those rejections were really, really kind of a bit of a shock, but they change you dramatically. And through that process of rejection, I became very, very independently minded.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the sculptural artist Andy Goldsworthy. Are most of your innovations by accident?
Intuition is incredibly important. And the ephemeral work made outside for the moment, for the day, is made in the spirit of experimentation. I make an awful lot of bad work. There are things that go wrong. You know, things go wrong, can fail. It's important that they do fail. And that is the food. That's the lifeblood of my work. And it is driven by intuition.
Your work and your, at least in the early days, ability to live so frugally implies a rich spiritual life. What religion are you?
None. I was brought up a Methodist. My mother and father were Methodist, but I'm not religious. What I do has a spiritual content to it. I mean, the feeling for place, understanding of a place and my place and my relationship to the people who've been there before me, the people who will come after me. I just recently did a work for the Yorkshire Sculpture Park containing a large flat-bedded rock. I lay down on the rock. It began to snow. I got up and left a shadow. And that stone has been laid on there as an invitation for others to lay on the rock and leave their shadow. And I like this sense of the stone becoming ingrained with the memory of the people who've laid upon it.
What about the physical toll that your work has on you? I'm trying to look at your hands. Can I see your hands? You haven't had a manicure in a while.
No, I've never had a manicure in my life.
Let me see them again. Put them on the table.
Well, that one, that kind of squash finger there is from working on the farm where I dropped the back of a trailer on it. I got one knuckle missing here from banging that. I got a good one here from a scar. Yeah, piece of slate. We were doing a test, testing out the material for the National Gallery piece in Washington. I went to the quarries and that slipped me up there. But I mean, generally, they're not in bad condition considering what I do.
You have a few books of your work, and one of your books is called Time. You talk about how you need the resistance of weather to help you work more. You like in the early afternoon when the day is the hottest, that's when you work best.
Well, actually, that sentence came out of initially, I hate the heat. I really dislike the heat. I'm much happier in a cold place. Heat is a problem for me. I get very hot. I don't know how to deal with it. And this was in the south of France. What I did was that I started working in the river. I actually sat in the river and made works, which was obviously cooler. So I started working in the river with these coloured stones, making lines that gradated from grey to white to yellow to red. And I began painting with stones. And underneath the effects of the water made the stones disappear, but the colour rise out. So I turned the stone to liquid colour in the river. And that was best at the middle of the day when the sun was at its hottest, because the sun was high and cast no shadow. So I turned what had originally been the most difficult time of the day in which for me to work to a sculpture that needed to be made at that time. That was a fantastic moment. And up till then, in hot places, I generally start getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, working, retreating in the middle of the day, and then coming out at night again. And somehow I always feel that's not dealing with the place properly, you know? So I do feel that if I can deal with it head on at its most difficult and make a great work, that is how it should be.
So there's that physical challenge for you.
Oh, I need that. When I'm in a gallery or work doing installations inside, I can only work for so long before the energy begins to drain out.
I want to talk about this sense of reversing nature. And what I'm thinking of is you're bringing these giant snowballs into the middle of London on a summer day. What inspires you to do that sort of thing?
The snowballs were left on the streets of London on Midsummer's Day. We put them out on the streets in the middle of the night, so nobody knew how they got there.
What were people's reactions?
Well, there was a disbelief that it was snow. And then I actually held a press conference that morning. I knew I would be fighting for the life of the snowball, so to speak. and that they could have lasted 10 minutes. People could have just, attacked them. And some of them lasted for 3 or 4 days. Most of them survived for a lot longer than I thought they would.
You have an important sense of place in your work. You did an exhibit at the Met, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, where you imported 30 rocks from Scotland to the rooftop of the Met. How come you just didn't use 30 rocks that you found, let's say, in Central Park?
There are occasions where, generally speaking, I like to work with the material that I find in a place. That's interesting. Also important to me is not just the rocks that I find, but movement and journeys and materials and also people take. And this journey from Europe to America is one that I do a lot, but it's got a long history to it, especially from Scotland. And granite bowls, it's Scottish granite, but there's, granite below you in the park. So I wanted to make that connection.
I want to talk about your personal life for a moment. You are divorced.
I am divorced, yeah.
How many children do you have?
I've got 4 kids.
What impact does the work have on your personal life?
Well, it is my personal life. It has no boundaries, as the making of art. I mean, it encroaches or enriches, depends how you look on it, on everything that I do.
You're married to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you source your inspiration?
When I went to Bradford Art School, there was a lot of performance and happenings works. People out there on the streets doing works on predictable things, which really informed me an awful lot. This idea of art being out of the studio in real places and the unpredictability of that. And nature has always been, and nature is not for me this kind of pastoral idyll that it's often perceived to be. The subject of nature is something that is supposed to be quaint and pretty. I mean, for nature for me has always been very raw and harsh and brutal and beautiful too. Mm. It's been the most difficult subject matter, not the easy option that people like to think of it sometimes.
You were also inspired by graves at St. Patrick's Church somewhere in England. Didn't you take pieces of ice from the graves?
On occasion, I did. Yeah, but they would freeze over, and every so often, I'd try and lift an entire human shadow, you know, this kind of shape up. The shape of that informed a work nearby when I was asked to do it was a private commission. I built three human-sized chambers for people to step into on top of this very bleak moor. The more people who step into this chamber, the more ingrained it will become with the memory of the people who stepped in there. And it is a place that's personally very important to me. But from that place, I could see the Morecambe Bay where I made my very first works. I could see the Morecambe where I was a student. I could see the church at Caton where I got married, because my ex-wife's village was there. I could see another couple of villages that I'd lived in. So there were all these places that I'd been in, had a relationship with, but was no longer there. And it was this sense that even though I'm not there, I still am connected to those places, that I've left a presence there.
How do you think you'll be entombed? You know, we're talking about graves, and there's a picture of you in one of your books throwing sand up in the air and just seeing wherever it would land, and it reminds me of cremated ashes. I'm wondering if you've ever thought about that for yourself.
Well, I have my father's ashes, which I'm going to make a throw from those at some point. But at the moment, it's in my will that I be buried next to the cairn that I made outside of Penpont, the village from where I live. And this work was made in response. The village asked me to make a millennium sculpture, and it stands there as a guardian to the village. So I would like to be buried next to that.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for asking me.
My guest has been Andrew Goldsworthy.
If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.